Okay, time again for Truth About Markets. Everyone buzzing about my appearance on BBC Daily Politics, Stacey.
Oh, yeah, honey money. This is Resonance 104.4 FM, and we are the Truth About Markets. I'm Stacey Herbert, and the other guy you heard is Max Kaiser. And Max was on Daily Politics show on Friday to discuss what, Max?
The bond apocalypse. Well, you know. I was on the Twitter with this guy named Liar Politicians, and he's always tweeting about Daily Politics on BBC with Andrew Neil, and he's been, you know, getting me on there and tweeting the producers. And so a few days ago, I suggested I go on yesterday because the GDP number would be released for the fourth quarter of 2012, and I was going, and I said it's going to be negative. I've said it's going to be negative for months, and so now the economy is on the triple dip doorstep, and so they had me on.
They had you on, and they had you on right after. Who is that?
Alexander.
Danny Alexander from the Lib Dems. He's the chief secretary to the Treasury, and it was quite amusing. We were sitting in the green hall, it wasn't really a green room, watching it, and he was just obliterated by Andrew Neil, because of course politicians can't tell the truth, can they? And he was trying to defend their policies, which have created a triple dip recession and 6 years of no growth, or 5 years of no growth. And then Max Kaiser went on, and the Sun journalists in particular really tried to have a go at you.
Right. Well, I, you know, stated that the and kicked it off in a big way that got everybody immediately, you know, turned their point of view around to my point of view, which is that the governments of the previous government and the current coalition government from during the 2008-2010 period, you know, they made the wrong choices. They made the wrong bets. Their theory was that the crisis was a liquidity crisis, and what they needed to do was to stopgap the economy with injections of liquidity into the banking sector. And then the hope was to reinflate the bubbles that were present at the time, principally the real estate bubble, and that 2 or 3 years later, that liquidity crisis will pass and the economy will be back to business as usual. But they didn't recognize that it wasn't a liquidity crisis. It was an insolvency crisis, as we pointed out at the time and a few others did. So just pumping money into insolvent banks, the big four banks are RBS, Barclays, HSBC, Lloyd's. It had no impact in stimulating the economy. Just like pumping blood into a corpse is not going to get the corpse to jump back to life. So here we are 5 years later, and the economy is in triple dip recession, or some might call it a depression. And the policy was wrong headed to begin with. And now the choices that are on the table are really, there are no choices, because the British pound was perceived as a safe haven currency, and so the bond market, the gilt market, the way that the UK funds its debts was liquid, because people were willing to buy these bonds with the perception that the UK was a safe haven, particularly when you look at what was happening in Europe and Greece and Spain and all these other countries. But now people are not really worried about the euro in Europe at the moment, and the UK has lost its safe haven status, so money is draining out. And the key is the interest rate on the 10-year gilt market, which hit a 350-year low in August. I mentioned this at the George Galloway event, that it was bottoming out, that it could only go higher. It's now at 2%. It's rising. So now interest rates, now all the options are, the UK is about to enter panic mode like they were in during the 70s. The UK will need an IMF-style bailout in the next 24 months. That's how dire the situation is.
But the one thing that's really different is the psychology of the population, because I'm just talking London. I'm not talking outside of London, because I know it's very dire out there, as dire as it's been in previous recessions. And you look at those charts they were showing last night on BBC Newsnight, and it's worse now in the UK than during the Great Depression. It's a worse economic disaster than the Great Depression. The worst since 1830, they said. Now, you would never know that being in London. So I was here in 1994, 95, at the depth of the last of a property crash. And it was genuinely bleak. And there was no life outside. Everybody was depressed. Nobody was out at restaurants and drinking. You don't see any sign of that in central London. Every Thursday, Friday night, but most nights, you know, every restaurant is packed. People are shopping. People are, you know, eating out at, you know, 50, 60 pounds a night to go out. And you see, you know, signs of that. But of course, the housing market has not crashed like it did in 94, 95 even. It's come down a little bit. And perhaps it's crashing in gold and silver terms. And it's also down in real terms. But nominally, people don't notice anything. And of course, the other difference between now and 94 is maybe half the people you pass in central London are not even British. They're either French, German, Italian, Spanish. Everybody is living here from the rest of Europe.
Right. Well, in 1994, was the last major bond collapse.
Oh, yeah.
So interest rates were roughly 6%, and they made a move to 8%. And the bond prices collapsed by 25%. And so what you're describing there was one of the worst bond collapses of the past 150 years. Since that time, the bond prices have moved up. Interest rates got down to 1.75%. Let's call it 2%. And we're going to see a move very quickly to 4%. So now that's 100% increase in interest costs versus the incremental cost from 6 to 8% we just mentioned for 1994. So therefore, the bond market, instead of dropping 25%, I think we can safely say it'll drop 50%. So the bond apocalypse, which is now coming, will be a much, much worse than 1994. Now, you know, you mentioned the real estate prices and what's happening in London. As I said, back in the 2008-2010 period, the choices and the decisions were made, the bets were made to bail out the banks and their mortgage-backed securities, which was primarily capitalizing the four big banks in the UK were these mortgage-backed securities. And the mortgage-backed securities at that time collapsed in value, but instead of forcing the banks to write those bad loans off, the government swapped treasury bills from the Bank of England directly into the banking system, and those bad debts are now on the books of the Bank of England. And the Bank of England has to pay interest on those bad debts, and those interest costs are part of the reason why the debt in this country is now at £1.4 trillion and growing quite quickly. Those bad debts are still in the system, they're still on the books, but the illusion is that they're worth 100 cents on the dollar, if you can maybe just not stick that right in my nose. And they're about 100 cents on the dollar, and as a result, you have this paper prosperity, which is the people in London have been beneficiary of that bailout. The real estate speculators have been the beneficiaries of the bailout. The real economy everywhere else in the country is suffering because they've been the credit taps have been turned off for everybody else. So they're experiencing this depression. But now that the bond market is ready to collapse, then you within London now will be facing a similar situation.
Well, yeah, and there's this, you know, you haven't cured the disease, the very uniquely, I think, a British disease of property speculation as a career. Because remember, we covered a few years ago the story from PricewaterhouseCoopers. They did a study. This is during the peak of the crisis, 2008, when the markets were collapsing, and they looked around the world, and it was the sovereign wealth funds that were rescuing a lot of economies around the world. And the biggest sovereign wealth funds were, the two biggest were Norway and Abu Dhabi. But they looked at Norway's sovereign wealth fund, which gave, you know, cash as king during a global Great Depression. And Norway was king during this time, and still is, because they had a massive sovereign wealth fund. And how they built up that sovereign wealth fund was they diverted a specific percentage every year of all the oil revenues from their North Sea oil supplies into the sovereign wealth fund for the future generations of Norway and the wealth of the nation. They spend every year whatever they've gained in interest or income on there. So they looked at what would have happened if the UK, which has not saved a single penny of their North Sea oil wealth, and they said had they even saved half of it, they would have one of the largest sovereign wealth funds in the world. But what they found was that almost all of it went it started with Thatcher, directly into property speculation. The government started earning income from North Sea oil, they used that money to reduce taxes on property. So they encouraged more property speculation. They were able to get rid of council housing and things like that. And then today, during this crisis, you know, for example, the UK introduced this funding for lending scheme. And this was meant to encourage banks. They gave banks cheap loans at, you know, below market interest rates in order to get the banks to lend it to small businesses. But it was all voluntary. You know, they just hoped they would, there was no mandate that they had to lend to small businesses. But instead they took the money, none of it, not a single penny actually went to small businesses. 100% of it has gone to property speculation. They've increased their mortgage lending.
Right, so this is a huge problem because these four banks have positioned themselves as the intermediary between the government and the economy. Mm-mm. So they've become trolls. You know, they live under the bridge between the government and the economy and the population, and they take huge fees, and they have this monopoly or oligopoly position, and they're parasites, and they are draining the economy of its integrity, and they're collapsing the economy and getting a fabulously rich doing so. You know, the bonuses are very high, and they're out in London spending lots of money. So there's a trickle-down effect here in London. People are out in the streets spending money. These are people who have relatives in the banking industry. They're people working in the banking industry or have friends who are splashing out with all the money that they're collecting as toll collectors, positioning themselves between the government and the population. So when you hear pundits on TV and you hear politicians on TV, all of the policies that they have, whether it's funding for lending, that's a scheme where the government is trying to get money into the economy through the banking system. They're funding the banks to lend to the economy. Well, the government can simply lend to the economy. The government doesn't have to fund the banks to lend to the economy. The government could very simply create a new bank called the New Bank, and they lend that and they loan money to that bank. It's called the New Bank, and then people can borrow money from that effectively directly from the government. But the four oligopolistically entrenched monolithic banks in the UK, their lobbying efforts have prevented any new banks from being created in this country in decades. Now, that's, if they wanted to jumpstart this economy, they would allow for five or six new banks to be created immediately. They would block these current four the four big banks from blocking the creation of new banks. They don't want the competition. Okay, I understand that. If you're in the business of banking or any business, you don't want competition. But you know, part of the role of the government is to promote competition.
Yeah, but don't you think it's also the psychology of the population? So compare the Brits to the Germans. Okay, on the one hand, you used to have, in 94, 95, when I moved here, you had all of these building societies. And what did the members of the building societies, i.e. the depositors, they all voted to sell to these big banks or to go public. Every single one of them took the £2,000 they got in exchange for that. So you lost all of those banks. Every single one of them has collapsed in this financial collapse. Now, compare that to the psychology of how the Germans work. All those middle-sized companies, all of them refuse to list publicly because they know it gets hollowed out. The shareholders demand the company be destroyed and parceled out and paid back to them in dividends or one-off payments. The Germans during this crisis, remember, Angela Merkel's party was trying to give away something. And the voters retaliated. They didn't want free giveaways because they knew they had to pay and it was just a sucker punch to pay them up. They're now having to introduce legislation because the property prices are rising so fast in Germany due to Greeks and Italians and people afraid of their own economies collapsing. So they're trying to get their cash out and deposit it somewhere else. So the Germans don't want that free money, though. They don't want the property price rises. So the psychology itself is different. Like it's a get rich quick mentality here. So everybody's in on the scams. It's always easy to get a certain percentage of the population to back a government scam because they want to flip a house. They want to get rich quick. They want to flip tear apart the building societies for £1,000.
Right. Well, the too big to fail banks here in the UK got to be too big to fail by buying up all the competition and all the building and loan associations and all the mutual banks were bought up and created this oligopoly. But the government right now facing now in a depression, a triple dip. The other name for that is called depression. And on television last night, they did a good chart on Newsnight showing that so far the depression was less economically damaging than the current triple dip recession. So this is worse than a depression. And the government, therefore, should step in and promote competition by allowing new banks to be formed and to compete with these oligopolists that are draining and blocking and preventing the kind of growth that they need. But, the government is so far, conflicted and they just have there's nobody there lobbying for competition. I think that's, everyone is talking about, they tend to talk about austerity in this country and the need to cut government programs and that government is the problem. That's false. The problem are these four too big to fail banks, and the government response should be to promote competition. That's one of the things government can do in a capitalist society is promote competition. This is something that the UKIP party folks never mention, but it is nevertheless they should mention it because they're for competition. And government can promote competition. They simply always paint government as anti-competition, but that's not true. The government fulfills two roles. They regulate and they promote competition. In this case, they should be promoting competition by allowing the new banks to be created.
Now, the other difference between today and the Great Depression, however, and why I think we're still going deeper, as you see from those charts, we're still deep in a depression, is inequality, the wealth and income gap. We got to as bad as right before the days before the Great Depression started in 2007. They were equal. In fact, a little bit past. And what that does, I think, is, once a guy has $5 billion and then the following year he's worth $10 billion, he's not altering his lifestyle. He's not spending more money because there's only so much you could spend. There's only so many houses you can have, only so many private jets you can have. And then you reach peak ability to even, you know, have enough days or hours in the day or days in the year to actually spend it. So that during the Great Depression, inequality went down. So people became more equal. The wealthy lost a lot compared to the average person. Here it's the opposite. In fact, the average person is losing a lot more. The wealthy have gained. They show all these numbers every year. It's like the wealthy gained $1 trillion in wealth this past year. Well, most of them aren't going to be able to spend it.
Well, I mean, in the Depression, you had the gutting of the Wall Street banker criminals. So you had over 1,000 bankers went to jail. They had the Pecora Commission. They set up the Securities Act of 33 and 34. And they re-architected and re-regulated the entire system, which was needed. And then you had a big growth phase in the 20th century. This crisis, there hasn't been any bankers going to jail. There's been no regulation. There's been no reform. There's only been a land grab by the biggest banks to get bigger. You know, there's a talk about too big to fail. It's a problem. So what do? They make them even bigger. So that's a big contrast between now and the Depression, is that the worst excesses of all the criminals that have caused this depression, the banking sector, have been rewarded by allowing to get even bigger. And, you know, you end up with like Jamie Dimon over there at J.P. Morgan. He's laughing about it. You know, he'll go on a conference in Davos and he'll be laughing at everybody like, ha, 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 ha.
Yeah, but you know, when people talk about money supply, there's plenty of money supply now. The governments, the central banks have pumped so much money in there. But what's missing is velocity of money. There's no circulation of money because, okay, some guy doubled his wealth from $5 billion to $10 billion or $10 billion to $20 billion in the last year. The Ambani, he's worth twice as much as he was last year. Abramovich is worth twice as much as he was 2 years ago. So, but he can't spend any more. It's not moving. It's all that money, that $10 billion more in his wealth just sits there in a like a rock that doesn't move. It's not flowing through the economy because he doesn't have any use for it.
And?
Well, that's what the economy needs, is velocity of money. It needs circulation, but there's no circulation because it's all sitting in the hands of some guys who don't need to spend it, who have more than they can possibly spend. And yet on the other side, you have people desperate for cash. They only have credit and credit cards. And it seems like it's a stall speed.
Well, that's what we're saying. We're saying that the Abramoviches, who are tied into these four big banks, they sit next to the government's money printing, and they get the money, and then it doesn't go anywhere else. So that's what we're saying. They're obstructionist. They're obstructing the velocity or the distribution of the money that's being printed. And the beneficiary of this has been the bond market, because people will say, well, we can fund our debt at 2% because they're buying bonds with that money that they're not allowing to circulate in the economy. But now, since the pound has lost its status as a safe haven currency and the bond market is selling off and we're looking at a 1994 25% or more crash, then that argument is falling apart. And the worst period of this crisis is now about to start.
Well, you know, another thing that happened this week is David Cameron has announced that sometime in the future, he promises they're going to have a referendum in out on Europe. Now, I'm not really quite sure about, like, what it would look different. I guess right now, there are no tariffs and things like that on trade with Europe. So if Brits decided to not be part of Europe, they would then have tariffs on their goods being sent to Europe. But it seems like they would also, I mean, like I was saying, one of the things that's quite remarkable now compared to 94, and maybe you're saying it'll change when the bond market collapses, but there are a lot of Italians, French, Spanish, you hear a lot of them around in central London, living here. So they've taken their wealth out of there and deposited in the housing market here. That's sustained this housing. It's prevented the bubble from collapsing. You know, the Economist magazine still says it's one of the most overpriced markets in the world. And that's due to all the European money and the Chinese and the Russian money coming in, I think. But so here, David Cameron has now introduced yet another element of instability and uncertainty into a very precarious global situation.
Well, I think that the EU debate is completely misrepresented and misunderstood, because everyone here, of course, is debating whether or not they want to be part of the EU. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that the whole nature of this debate is that Germany has already decided that they don't want Britain in the EU, because they want the pendulum of the European banking center to swing from the city of London to Frankfurt. Mm-hmm. They want that business. The euro is the most widely circulated currency in the world. It's the eurozone is the biggest economic zone in the world. But they play second fiddle to the city of London and the banking center in the city of London. And that's and as you know, the city of London is, if you look at all the contingency aspects to the banking industry here, it's 20% of GDP. So it's a huge piece of business that Frankfurt wants. They want that business. They want the euro and the Frankfurt to be, and it's already, you know, the Economist magazine has already said that in the next couple of years, you're going to have New York, Hong Kong, and Frankfurt. And then the UK will drop from being number one to number four. And that's what Germany wants. And that's what Germany is getting, because Germany knows how to play Britain. They know that if they can set it up as a debate between the two parties, that these two parties will nibble each other to death. And then they'll sleepwalk into being kicked out of the euro. Out of the EU, which is what Germany wants. You know, and Merkel says, oh, we want you to be part of Europe, and we you know, she doesn't want them to be part of Europe. The UK economy, it's a 1.5 trillion pound economy. It's compared to a 14, 15, 16 trillion eurozone economy. It's just a little pinprick of an economy compared to the eurozone, but yet they garner the lion's share of transactions in the city of London. So Frankfurt's saying, no, that's not right. We want that business. So what'll happen is that the UK pound, to stay competitive, will have to be devalued, which is what I also said on the Andrew Neil show. The UK pound will have to be devalued. So inflation is going to keep becoming a very big problem, and the only way to protect yourself is with gold and silver. You know, gold and silver have maintained your purchasing power for the 10 years we've recommended it on this show, and will continue to do so.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, because I did notice that, you know, when David Cameron announced this referendum possibility out in the future sometime in 2017, you know, they spoke to the former Belgian prime minister, the foreign secretary for France, and they were all like aghast and saying this is treason, basically. But Germany was the only one like, yeah, encouraging it, saying that's a good idea. They should do that. Mm-hmm. Let their people speak, because they knew, that it would probably be better for Germany. And it's a way to be better for Germany that, unlike the previous Great Depression times, they're not like overtly being hostile and aggressive in expanding their power.
Yeah, exactly. They're not being overtly or hostile in expanding their power, but they are expanding their power. You got to go back to France under Mitterrand, and Helmut Kohl in Germany who hatched this plan of creating the euro to begin with as part of reunification. That was the quid pro quo. Germany can reunify. Remember, there used to be East Germany and West Germany. Now there's only Deutschland. You know, it's been reunified. And it's the most successful economy in the world right now. Bigger, more successful than China. It's got the best export business. Their social welfare programs are in surplus. Medical, welfare, retirement welfare, they're in surplus.
So I see some papers were reporting that Nicolas Sarkozy is going to move to London and set up some private equity fund. But I'm not so sure of that because he's more of a Machiavellian political character. And his children are all on the ladder of political success in France and will probably one day be prime ministers or presidents and stuff like that. So it just seems it seems like it was just a tabloid story, like trying to conjure up French trouble.
Yeah, he's not going to move to London. He can move to New York because New York and America and France are very close and they have a close ties. But, you know, France and Britain hate each other. Mm. Sarkozy's not going to move to Britain. You know, that's not going to happen. And but he'll move to New York.
Actually, I heard somebody suggesting that for the next elections, it was actually my French friend who had just spent Christmas back in Strasbourg. And she was saying that the talk was that everybody hates François Hollande. Like, I mean, this is typically French, of course. As soon as they elect a president, they hate them. Their ratings plummet to negative within 2 or 3 weeks. But she was saying that everybody was talking about, you know, the opposition party now, so Sarkozy's party, that everybody's expecting and hoping that Christine Lagarde runs for president next election cycle.
Mm-hmm. Well, probably, sure. That makes sense. Remember, Dominic Strauss-Kahn was going to be the president. He's going to challenge the previous IMF head. He's going to challenge Sarkozy. And, you know, France loves their technocrats and their financial wizards and their, you know, their Milton Friedman advocates and their Chicago school. So she's, you know, doing a bang-up job over there at the IMF, and she's rubbing elbows at Davos. So I'm sure she will be the next president.
That would be the first time they have a woman president, of course. So I was reading a story on the internet. This is from The Guardian. Revealed who can fly drones in UK airspace. Missile manufacturer, police forces, and a golf video company among more than 130 groups licensed to use the technology. So there are all these mini drones like that, mm-hmm, flying overhead, taking photos of us, at least 130. This is from Freedom of Information. And so they're allowed to fly these unmanned vehicles overhead, not higher than 400 feet. And they're taking photos of people for various reasons. But again, like everything, I guess in our bubble economies, we just don't notice these things happening around us as like the prison walls are coming in on us. They're literally erecting a prison around you and you don't even notice it. You're just like freely walking around, you think, and consuming and doing your stuff. And one day you're going to wake up and notice that the cell walls have come in closer and closer on you.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking actually about a kind of something similar, that they say this is a depression, but, you know, you look at the images of the depression and it's different. You know, you had obviously people sleeping, you know, homeless people lined up at soup kitchens, and it was a big story. You don't really have that anymore as such, because I think this is an interesting version of the depression where it's like subsistence meets just-in-time supply chain management. So you have people that are one sandwich away from being destitute and homeless, but that last sandwich during the last mile is getting to them. You know, they're making another 10 pounds to keep them from being completely destitute and homeless. And it's happening because the economy of the past 10 or 15 years has become, has changed radically in terms of the ability to move things and money around using internet technology and other forms of technology. So I think there's a depression, but it's hard to see it because people are able to work 20 hours a day. They can just get by. They're just there. There seems to be a different face of the depression. That people say depression and they expect men in trench coats, you know, as hobos on the railway or something. But there's a depression, but it looks different because the way society is organized is very, very different than it was even 15 years ago. So I think that's an underreported aspect to it. It's hard to gauge, but there's something going on there.
Well, of course, the modern welfare state was created post-World War II. So even during the Great Depression, a family would have had to take care of their old mothers and fathers as well, feed them and house them and take care of their medical care. Now, even in the U.S., for people over 65, there's Social Security and there's Medicare. So they're taken care of. You're not having to take care of them as well. There's no burden on your taxes. Here, you know, the NHS was created after World War II, the dole, all that stuff. These people would have had to have, you know, relied on charity.
Yeah, so instead of being, let's say, subsistent farm workers on the working as serfs, so you have millions of people who are disabled, who are living in old age homes, who are on benefits. They're serfs essentially. They're living on subsistence money, and there are millions of them. But I guess maybe part of it is the fact that the prices of stuff is very, very cheap. So you can buy a new jacket that's made in China and it arrives here and you can buy it for £5. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here's a person that is basically one sandwich away from destitute, but they have a new $5 jacket on. So it doesn't really appear to be, you know, ordinarily they would be without the, you know, it's like there's a shininess to this destitution.
Well, it's the opposite of what your mom was telling me, the story about living in the Great Depression in Wisconsin. And she said there was no money. Money was hard to come by, but there was no problem at all with food because everybody was a farmer. So you always ate good food. And she remembers eating blueberries and strawberries and things like that. But clothes were more expensive and difficult to come by, so they had to sew old clothes into new clothes, especially for the children, because they're growing. And, you know, shoes used to be expensive and real. They were made of leather and handmade. So those kind of things were harder to come by. But you're right, everything is shiny now.
Yeah, you have shiny clothes and a cell phone. You know, you can get cell phones for cheap money. And so you have a cell phone, you have a shiny jacket, you have a plastic shoes, Crocs or something. You're walking around. You're basically in a depression. You're destitute, but it doesn't really, you know, it's a different form. I think it goes to my theory of the insectualization, you know, becoming more insect-like, where you have the worker bees and they're just feeding into the social networking somehow. But there's no dignity.
Well, even, watching programs about Africa now, a lot of they talk about all the clothes being made by all the products available from China. The Chinese made bicycles, which are big there because they're so much cheaper than European or American made ones. All the clothes. So everybody does look shiny. There's like they all have brand new t-shirts and shorts on. They're Chinese made. But so it's hard to gauge there's a certain sameness about everybody around the world. They all kind of, nobody looks like they're really struggling like when clothes were handmade and expensive to get, when everybody looked raggedy. I remember Richard Russell, who is a famed investor, and he wrote like 2 years ago a piece we read where during the Great Depression, when he was like 7 or 8 years old, he remembers specifically the first year everything seemed okay. His uncle at the time had been living off of his bonds, his portfolio, and the interest on his bonds was enough to help him out. But as it, when it got cut in half, and the dividend payments, when they got cut in half, he noticed like after a year, people's shoes, that's where he started to see that people were actually suffering because they were starting to get raggedy shoes and holes in their shoes, which you never saw before. And then his uncle actually did commit suicide, just jumped out a window when he couldn't afford it anymore. But there's no, you don't see people with holes in their shoes walking around.
No, there's a certain, there's a plastic, this is the plastic depression. But we talk about dividends, and back in the 30s, dividends are something people actually invested for. And cash flow, and a gold-backed currency, and low debt levels. These were the predominant themes. But now people don't look for dividends anymore. Google doesn't pay a dividend. Apple pays, just started paying a dividend. It's a very small dividend. Facebook doesn't pay a dividend. The biggest corporations in the world that are technology-oriented don't pay dividends. The dividend yield on stocks is very, very low. Dividend yield on bonds is almost non-existent. So the whole idea of dividends is really gone completely out of fashion. People are speculating on the asset values of things like their homes, because when the value of the asset price goes up, they can borrow more against it. And remember, at the peak of the real estate bubble, people were borrowing against their homes. The homes were tied to their checking account in this country. So every time the home values went up 5% or so, the bank would release more money that you could take out of your cash machine against the collateral of your home. So your indebtedness versus your home was always at the absolute maximum. So that's a big fundamental change from cash flow, savings, and dividends to pumped up real estate values from banking machinations and central bank money printing to, and this goes back to 2008, 2010. There was a crisis because the real estate market crashed, and all the financial instruments that were tied to the real estate, the mortgage-backed securities, were therefore insolvent. They were worth nothing on the dollar. But the government came in and decided to buy worthless mortgage-backed securities to keep the banks afloat in an attempt to keep the bubble going and reinflate the bubble. And for 5 years, there's been this fake economy that's been reinflated by central bank buying of mortgage-backed bonds, but now that's finished. Now we see that the GDP never materialized. So therefore, there's never going to be enough income to pay the interest on the debt that was incurred to keep the bubble afloat. That's not going to happen. And if you look at the British TV pundits now, they're all panicking because they were told a lie. They're waking up from this lie that there will be no GDP growth to fund the debt that was put in place to keep the real estate bubble afloat. Now, because everyone's on a tracker rate and interest rates are going to double, they're going to go from 2 to 4 to 6%, you're going to have another real estate crisis. But the government is already at record indebtedness, so they can't expand into more debt, although they will. And then, of course, the rating agencies will downgrade British debt. The British pound will crash, and then we'll start to see some true evidence of what's really going on here. Then you'll start to see the people won't even be able to buy that $5 plastic Chinese-made coat anymore.
Well, you know, when you speak about that dividend and non-dividend paying stocks, just yesterday I read a piece about that. I think it was on Business Insider, where they actually looked at a portfolio, had you invested, I think it was 1980, $10,000 in the top 10 non-dividend paying shares and the top 10 dividend paying shares. And today that $10,000 in the non-dividend paying shares would be worth $180,000. In the dividend paying one, it would be $450,000. So it was the propaganda, really, that, you know, this is a mighty fast growth company. This is what you want, the rising asset values. But in fact, you would have made a lot more in a very unsexier way, but you would have doubled had you invested in just dividend paying shares.
Right, because you're taking advantage of the compounded rate of interest, because the dividends are reinvested in the shares. So you've got the, and as the shares, you now own more shares that therefore pay more dividends. So people tend to forget about that. But also, if you, okay, you go back to 1980 and you do a study like that and you say, oh, wow, this portfolio doubled in value simply by looking at dividends. And then you go look at someone like a Warren Buffett, who is considered to be the most successful investor ever. And if you look at his track record, basically, he's just buying very kind of numbnuts companies like chewing gum and railways, paid nice dividends, and he sits on them for 20 or 30 years. That's it. That's his whole secret. So he has, basically, his whole secret is he's patient, and he's not, he's in the insurance business with his primary business is Berkshire Hathaway is an insurance company. And if you know the insurance industry, you know that almost 90 to 95% of every single insurance company has been involved in a major scandal of one or another, because it's the easiest business in the world. People just send you money because they're frightened, and you have to pay out some of it every once in a while, and that's it. Now, the temptation to abuse that is too great, and virtually every single insurance company that's ever existed has gotten involved in some scandal, except Warren Buffett, because he's just decided, well, you know what, maybe there's more money to be made in not being a crook in the insurance industry, and I'll take all the premiums I'm collecting and I'll buy, you know, chewing gum companies and Coca-Cola companies and railway companies, and just sit on them for 20 years. Oh, okay, I guess that worked. Yeah, it worked very well.
Well, it just shows you the whole psychology is, you know, you could tell people these facts, probably. You could sit down and say that, you know, your $10,000 would turn into $180,000 with these, you know, sexy, talked about CNBC pushed.
Well, look, we've had this exact experience for the past 10 years.
Yeah.
We've been buying gold and silver. Now, gold and silver have outperformed Warren Buffett by a factor of 300%. They've been the best performing assets in the world by a huge gap. Nothing even comes close except for maybe oil. And yet people still write us emails saying, how could you be recommending these horrible things, gold and silver, when everyone knows that they've never done anything? So they just have a bias. Most people can't get over their bias. They don't let the facts get in the way of their opinions. They just decided that this is the way it is, and they'll just open their mouth and the words will start coming out, even though there's no relation to reality at all. And here we'll say it again. For the next 10 years, the best investments will be not Berkshire Hathaway and not stocks and bonds. It'll be gold and silver. And every single month for the next 10 years, people will say, that's impossible. That's not true. How could you say that? You're a gold bug. It's ridiculous, and, you know, we'll be right, just because we're looking at the facts.
Yeah, that was the most remarkable thing at the 10-year anniversary of 9/11. I remember they put out a chart saying the top 10 investments since that day of 9/11 and the 10 worst. And I swear to God, number one was silver. But the amount of hate mail we had received saying, how can you push silver? How can you push silver? You scammed everybody. It was the number one returning investment of the previous 10 years, 900% increase in returns. Mm-hmm. And yet some of the ones that were 10 worst were considered the safe haven ones. And you should forget silver. It's crazy. It's volatile. You'll lose money. The ones that actually lost money, in the minds of most of the population, would have been considered far safer and secure, and that's where your store of wealth.
That's right. Well, you know, because all the financial media is pushing the paper. And during the bond market rally, which lasted 30 years, I mean, it was one of the most longest running rallies in history, was the bond rally from 1980 to just a few months ago. This was the most longest running rally of any market ever. But it's over. It's finished. You know, you can't, bonds are not going to, you know, they went to negative yield in a couple of countries, but that's completely unsustainable. And now they're going to start, yield's going to go up, prices are going to go down. So, of course, in the last 3 years, the legacy of the crisis of 2008 is that hundreds of billions of dollars and pounds and euros went into bond funds.
Pension funds.
Right. Now, all those people are going to lose 25 to 50% of their investment. And, of course, the mainstream media will say nobody saw it coming. And they'll say that. Of course we saw it and we warned you about it. They'll just outright lie, and precious metals will go up. And you know, oh my God, it's a sound out there. There's a phone sound.
It's a phone sound. It's not a big deal. Max is scared. He wants to invest in Apple shares now because he hears a phone ringing. Oh, it is an Apple phone. Hey, you know, in our last 2-3 minutes here. What do you think about Apple being, it's down like a big time. How many percentage points? 20-30% since its peak. It was at 700. Now it's at 500.
Yeah, it was at 700. Now it's at 450.
Whoa.
Right. Well, the history of Apple before it went on a tear starting in, 2000 was it was a very volatile stock that were and it was a heartbreaker of a stock, and that's why a lot of people didn't buy Apple from when it went from basically 26 up to 200. Then it went from 200 to 700, and it pulled in a lot of people, and the hedge funds were owning it. Now it missed, you know, revenues and earnings for the quarter, and it's got a lot more competition, and so it you know, it traded off, but what's...
Well, Reggie Middleton was great at calling that for sure. And I remember sitting with him in New York almost a year ago and him saying Samsung would be the place to go. That's gonna destroy Apple.
Well, you know, it's funny because when Apple stock was at 20, you know, Michael Dell famously said that Apple should just shut down and pay and liquidate themselves and send their shareholders cash. And Dell was it's a PC company, and it was really hugely popular. And then, so nobody wanted Apple. You couldn't give the stock away. And then it went from basically 20 to 700, and it made a lot of people lots and lots of money. When it got to 700, everyone was buying Apple, and they said, this is going to be the first $1 trillion company, and the stock's going to 1,000. Mm. And nobody would argue that this wasn't the greatest stock you could possibly own at $700 a share. Now it's at 450, so it got completely crashed. But again, the consensus tends to be completely wrong because there's a bias confirmation at the bottom. Everyone says, oh, this is horrible. And since everyone is saying it, it must be true. And everyone loved it at 700. So, applying that to gold and silver, people still hate gold and silver, which should give you an idea why it's still a good investment. Not until gold gets to 10,000. And everyone you talk to is buying gold, will it then be possible, you know, that'll be the time to exit.
Yeah, but, and finally, on the Apple story, they said they have cash reserves of $140 billion. I mean, this must be historic. That's like the size of some of the S&P 500. That's bigger than probably half the S&P 500.
Right, but if they're not getting any return on that cash, that's not necessarily good for the stock. So how do they get a return on that cash? Either they invest it in new products, and those new products might not be popular. You know, Apple has created some duds along the way. Not everything has been a smash hit, and the guy who created all the smash hits is gone. Okay, so then what? Then number two, they could pay a dividend. Well, that's a one-time thing. That's not going to be any long-term growth. So the fact that the smart thing to do would be to buy silver and gold with that cash, because they would then have insulation against the fall in value of fiat currencies, and they'd have a ready supply of silver, which they use in their products.
So, well, that's getting towards the end. Well, that is the end of our show here. It's a good to end on gold and silver. That's still the story for 2013. 2014.
Still is.
Better than investing in the referendum that might happen by 2017.
Yeah, no, that's no good.
Okay, well, this has been The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM in Central London. I'm going to call this The Truth About Shiny Clothes and a Cell Phone. I like that phrase. So that's it for us.
Bye, y'all.